Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is you don't talk about Right Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello, welcome to Right Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. Today, I'm joined by Teresa, Nicola, Linda, Heather and Steph.
Hello!
And this week on Write Club, we're going to be talking about the importance of the first five pages of a novel and trying to identify the critical factors. Before that, Steph will be reading from the opening pages of her novel, Lacking Grace. Also today, Nicola will be sharing some amusing quotes on writers and writing. Looking forward to that. Teresa and Liz Stoker will be telling us what's on their bedside tables. But first of all, Linda is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Yes, I am. Okay, are you ready? You know what, when you're preparing these clues, it's always really a little question. Is that too hard? Or is, I'll read you my clues and you can let me know.
Okay.
Ready?
Mm-hmm.
This 1982 epistolary novel, later a film and a musical, is number 17 on the American Library Association's list of the 100 most frequently challenged books of 2000 to 2009 because of explicit content, especially violence.
Ooh, 1982. That's
what I was thinking.
It's a musical too.
Oh, yeah, I know. Oh, musical. Oh, I got the film.
Well, it's later a film and a musical.
So, you know, you were saying, are the questions too hard or too easy?
Yeah.
Too hard.
I might have
number
it.
Two.
Oh, okay.
It is set in the southern United States, mostly rural Georgia, and deals with the plight of African-American women.
Yeah. That well,
not
maybe,
what I thought.
Maybe.
Is that a...
I'm not aware of it as a musical, so I don't think I'm right. Well, it was my first thought before, and then I changed it.
Okay.
I've got two things written down. I think they're both wrong.
Let's see here. First line, third clue. You better not never tell nobody but God and kill your mammy.
Yeah.
Oh, Heather has it.
Book of Mormon.
Huh?
Is it the Book of Mormon?
No.
Is it the color purple?
Yes.
I didn't think it from the first clue, and then I didn't know it was a musical.
I didn't know that was a musical.
The Book of Mormon is a musical.
It's much more recent.
And it's about African American women?
No. There are African American women.
Oh,
are there?
Okay. But I didn't know the color purple had been made into a musical either. So it doesn't seem like.
But the main character is a singer, isn't she? Or one of the main characters?
Shug Avery is a singer. The first clue, Teresa said, was too hard.
But I did actually think The Colour Purple, and then when you said it was a musical and extreme violence, I thought, oh, maybe
the violence bit made me think I was wrong, but then you didn't.
Yeah. And then the southern states, mostly rural Georgia, African American women, and then that gave it to you, probably.
Yeah.
Second clue was too easy.
Thank you, Linda. Well, as I said at the beginning, we're going to be discussing the openings of novels. And Steph, you're reading from the opening to your novel, Lacking Grace.
I am, yeah. I'm reading a few pages in, but we're still in the first few pages, so here we go. Another loud knock from the front of the house brought Grace back to the moment. Have you two been playing around the buses again? She asked the boys with a slight frown. Bobby took his thumb out of his mouth for a second to deny the charge, while Freddie shook his head vigorously. So it wouldn't be that horrid chap from the bus station who'd come round complaining about the twins playing there. He had been a thin, mean-mouthed man. Grace had studied the pearl of mucus at the end of his sharp nose, the way his tongue had flicked across his upper lip, the feather on his hat, the badge on his lapel. But not once did she meet his eyes. Grace knew he might try to plant thoughts in her head if she did, and she was too clever for him. It was unlikely to be any of her neighbours calling. Grace kept her distance. She didn't need their help or advice. Busybodies, most of them, and they'd soon got the message. Even Mrs. Sugden from next door gave her a wide berth these days. Grace had caught the woman crouching behind the red brick wall that separated their small back gardens, eavesdropping on conversations she'd been having with Blue. Grace had given the nosy park a short shrift. The noise from the front door came again. two beats this time, spaced half a second apart. Whoever was there wanted her attention. They weren't going away. Grace pulled off her headscarf and checked her appearance in the mirror above the fireplace, running her fingers through honeyed curls which bounced obediently into place. She stepped onto the terracotta tiles of the hallway. The stained glass panels in the heavy door framed a dark silhouette. Everyone knew stories of women left catatonic by a slip of paper brought by the telegram boy, announcing a change of status from wife to widow, and Grace had rehearsed the scene in her head regularly. Ships were lost in the Atlantic daily, stalked by U-boats, hell-bent on preventing supplies from reaching British shores, and Grace made plans for when the news reached her that her husband Albert had been killed at sea. She was determined to be ready and behave in the appropriate manner. Only last night she had revised her short explanation to her sons. She knew the words of sympathy she would write to Albert's mother and the brave dignity with which she would take her children to visit their father's memorial stone each Sunday. Sometimes she imagined herself weeping while her neighbours tiptoed in to console her. Other times she liked to think she'd received the condolences of her neighbours silently, only the pallor of her skin and the dark circles under her eyes betraying her grief. Her community would talk in hushed whispers about her bravery and stoicism. They'd realise they'd misjudged her. This was not simply a macabre fascination, it was also a way to test how she felt. When she thought of herself as a widow, she'd make plans. Get rid of the old armchair he so loved, throw away his ridiculous collection of Toby jugs, and the battered tankard he insisted on drinking his beer from at Christmas. There were other days when she'd wailed for the loss of him. How could she bear it if he never came home? Her poor, fatherless children.
Yeah. I think that's a very powerful piece myself. You know?
Yeah.
All the thoughts and all. And I was just noticing as you read along that I didn't see... It's so smooth. I didn't see the transition from going into the hall and thinking about the present until, well, the transition was when she's thinking about somebody delivering a slip of paper, etc., and then you go into everything else. So that was very clever, very good, very smooth.
It was good.
Yeah.
A great introduction to Grace and her mindset. We start to see that, you know, about, I think she says somewhere, oh, yes, the sort of third or fourth paragraph, he might try to plant thoughts in her head, yes, and she was too clever for him. So already we're starting to get an inkling of the way her mind works,
right,
that people can put things in your head. So I thought that was very effective, introducing us to those issues with Grace. I wondered if the opening was a bit too abrupt. I know you like to start in media res, but of course you did say this isn't the beginning.
No, this isn't the very beginning.
So I've read it as if it was, as if it was the beginning. So where you say another loud knock from the front of the house brought Grace back to the moment. Yeah, presumably, we know what she's doing.
We've had a knock, and she's been wondering. She's looked out into the garden and seen the bonfire.
Yeah,
and saying it can't be about the blackout regulation.
Okay,
and then the knock at the door comes again, and then she thinks perhaps it's the man at the garage.
Right. Because I was wondering. You know, I couldn't quite visualise it. Was she daydreaming whilst wiping down the kitchen table when the door knocked? Or
this is the second, the door knocks three times.
I see. Okay, that's fine. That answers that. So it's not as abrupt as I thought. Yeah, I think when you mention U-boats again, I think that puts it in a particular time more than any of the other things. You know, we know the idea of waiting for a telegram, but that could be anything from the Boer War forward. Yeah. So that you know, I don't know what's gone before, so whether that is important
or
whether
it's... In the previous part, the knock comes at the door, she looks out the window, sees the bonfire, thinks, no, that bonfire was out long before blackout.
Yeah.
So it can't be another summons. And then she remembers going to court.
Mm.
And then she remembers how her neighbours have been horrible to her. And they were shouting at her because of her bonfire, because it was wash day. At the very opening, she and her boys are dancing and singing.
Right.
And it says air raids, bombs and rations were forgotten.
Okay, it's all there. Yeah. Okay,
then comes the bit about the knock at the door and her going out the window at the bonfire and remembering blackout. So hopefully the time you get to U-boats, you know it's the second one.
Yeah.
And I think all the phraseology is so appropriate, the nosy Parker, the busybodies, you know, and I think that, again, sets it in its time as well. So yeah. That was very well done. Sometimes with your writing, and I think maybe it's just me, but sometimes I think there's almost a detail too far. Mm-hmm. And I felt that about stepping onto the terracotta tiles of the hallway and the stained glass panels in the heavy doorframe. Mm. For me, and it's a really nitpicky thing, and maybe different people respond differently, but it's just like maybe too much.
I noticed two uses of the neighbours in that as I'm Just when you think it's finished.
Yes,
no, absolutely. No, it's only my opinion, you know. And I, as always, really well written, and I think the reader will be intrigued and want to know more, and sympathise with Grace, because we see her besieged by neighbours and Jobsworths and, you know. So I think it engages the reader well.
I'm not bothered by the church and the tiles and the stained glass and the door and stuff, because I'm very visual, and when I...
Yeah, you do. You give a lot of detail really effortlessly, and we are sucked in immediately to her inner world. I was particularly, fascinated by the visualization she was doing of how she would feel if she became a widow, because there's something people with vivid imaginations do a lot, and great clues dropped in about the fact that all is not well in her mental world. Mm-hmm. There was just one tiny thing when you said the telegram that might render her catatonic. I just thought that was too strong a word and a little bit too mental orientated, perhaps something, prostate or prostrate. It's not prostrate. I'm not sure how you actually spell that word. Yeah.
Prostrate. Everyone knew stories of women left catatonic.
Yeah. That just seemed a bit too strong to me. And perhaps, in view of the fact that we're moving on to a mental health. Mental health thing. You don't even need to bring that in yet, perhaps. Yeah. But apart from that, absolutely gripping. Loved the repulsive man from the garage. little bit worried about the boys, because if they're young enough to suck their thumbs and they're going playing with buses, that's all going to end in tears, isn't it?
But well, that's how the world's moved on.
Absolutely, absolutely. But great.
That really did happen.
I'm sure.
It was a real life.
I'm sure, but his drop of mucus at the end of his nose repulsed me perfectly.
That's disgusting. Thank you. I can rehearse something before it happens.
Yeah.
If I've got a meeting in the morning, or if somebody wants to talk to me, I've rehearsed what's going to happen in my head. It's never anything like you imagine as well. But it just reminded me of the things that go through my head before.
I think we all do that to a certain extent, don't we? You sort of plan for the worst, and there's almost a superstitious thing that because you've thought it's not going to happen, the worst won't happen.
I think the exact opposite. If you think it is going to happen,
it's a bit of gross that wants it.
Yes. Yeah.
You can tell that.
I mean, I think what strikes me is, I know what you're saying about, we all do that to a certain extent, but I think the potential reactions, because the way that she has alternative scenarios, all sort of seem quite theatrical.
Yes.
And
she grew up in
you're
left
wondering, does she want him dead?
Yes.
Does she want to him? If so, why? The little hint about the community were talking hushed whispers about her bravery and stuff, and they'd realised they'd misjudged her, and she's becoming the heroine of
her story.
And you think, how have they misjudged her? So there's lots of questions will drag the writer in.
That's what I was hoping to create, so thank you.
Yeah.
But then I have a feeling that she gets a little of the guilt for what she's thinking, because she does say sometimes she really cries and thinks about her poor father and children and stuff.
Yeah, but even she's not crying for the loss of Albert.
She's imagining it's like a soap opera scenario.
Melodrama. Which is with her musical theatre background.
Yeah.
Appropriate. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I think we might well be picking up on some of the points we've made there about some of the things in those first few pages. later on. But I think before that, Nicola,
yes,
to lighten the mood slightly,
yes,
I believe.
Well, I hope so, because when I was preparing this, I just thought I'd try and find some stuff about how, whether other writers find it so hard to actually write anything. So here are some quotes about writers and writing. I get up in the morning, torture a typewriter till it screams, then stop. That's Clarence Budlington Kelland. Robert Heinlein said, I have this one nasty habit, it makes me hard to live with. I write. Writing is antisocial. It's as solitary as masturbation. Disturb a writer when he's in the throes of a creation, and he's likely to turn and bite right to the bone. And not even know he's doing it. Then, this is a good one. I realised I was officially a professional writer when all my plans began with drink coffee and ended with take a nap. Cassandra Duffy. Many writers are like me, fascinated by process. Now, I notice this in our interviews. I always want to ask about process, so this one jumped out at me. Many writers are like me, fascinated by process. From an early age, I wanted to know whether authors worked by morning or night, whether they typed or wrote by hand, and if so, on what kind of paper, whether they had their backs to the window, drank wine, stood, sat, or lay on their backs with their legs in the air. That was Stephen Fry. Douglas Adams says it's almost impossibly hard. It is supposed to be. But once you truly understand how difficult it is, it all becomes a lot easier. Thomas Mann said, a writer is a person for whom writing is more difficult than for other people.
Yeah, interesting.
Well, that was good. And the best advice about creativity I've ever received is write drunk, edit sober. Often attributed to Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and that's it.
That's some good ones. Can I add one to that?
Oh, yes,
just
do.
Reminded me of something I came across when we were talking about detectives. This is from Raymond Chandler in a letter to the editor of the Atlantic Monthly. It says, by the way, would you convey my compliments to the purist who reads your proofs and tell him or her that I write in a sort of broken-down patois, which is something like the way a Swiss waiter talks, and that when I split an infinitive, God damn it, I split it so it will remain split.
Yeah.
And when I interrupt the velvety smoothness of my more or less literate syntax with a few sudden words of barroom vernacular, this is done with the eyes wide open and the mind relaxed and attentive. The method may not be perfect, but it is all I have.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You can just imagine somebody correcting all this stuff and putting it into grammatically correct.
Yeah. Keep your grungy hands off my prose.
Yeah. That was wonderful. Yeah, but that's some really good ones there.
Yeah.
Okay, on to more serious matter. How long do you give a book before you decide whether you're going to stick with it or abandon it?
Well, it depends. Sometimes I'll give it quite a long time. You know what I mean? If I think it might be worth persevering, if it's something that's been recommended or that's a classic or whatever. But if it's something that I just, in the first page or two, I just think this is so badly written, it's not for me, it's not my taste, 50 Shades of Grey.
Yes.
You know. I just think, no, life's too short. At one time, if I started a book, I finished it. It was almost religious. But now there are so many good books I want to read, and even books I'd rather reread than read something which I consider to be poor or uninteresting.
Yeah.
So
I used to give a book 50 pages. And if you didn't have me about 50 pages, I figured you're not doing your job. I'm not going to waste my time on this. Mm-hmm. However, I've gotten even more impatient in recent years. I don't want to give it that much time. You really should have me earlier than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I will stick with a book longer if, or in the first page or two, they've introduced a character that I find really interesting and want to know more about. Then I will stick with it a little bit more to see, not more than 50, but I'm saying now I'll probably go maybe 20, 25 pages. But I, the older I get, the less time I want to waste on reading bad writing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I do think that the author's job is to get me hooked right away.
Yeah. So, you say bad writing there, but, you know, what if it's a book that's supposed to be good writing and it doesn't hook you or you don't find a character you like? Is that still bad writing, in your opinion?
I think it is. I'm not talking about the quality of the the technical points. I'm talking about good writing being something that's interesting and that I want to read.
Mm-hmm. So, a really sympathetic character.
Right. Yeah. If you don't have me wanting to continue your book very soon, then I'm not going to waste my time on it because I think that's bad writing. Okay. Not booking is bad writing.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fair enough, even if something is deemed good or, you know, it has won prizes or is a classic or whatever. If you're not enjoying it, mm-hmm. that's okay. It's bad right. writing.
There was a Will Self book. I wish I could remember what it was called. It's a Will Self book with no punctuation, yeah. no parentheses, no nothing. And I really tried, but I just...
Yeah. That's style. Mm-hmm. That's a... Yeah, it's a style. It's
sort of
stylized,
an experimental
isn't it?
Style.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's Heather and... Yeah. Wait. What was the one that we talked about?
Yeah, a girl's half-formed thing.
Which was majorly reviewed. It was...
It won all sorts of them.
And just could not get to grips with it.
Really?
Then on the other hand, I read the first page of a book for an exercise. Mm. You know, just read the first page of a book and answer some questions. And it was so gripping. That I then had to go and buy the book and read the whole thing. And I was really disappointed because the first page was
the best.
I kept reading thinking, it will get better again in a minute. Yeah. It didn't.
Oh, that reminds me of something Liz Harris said some weeks ago when we talked to Liz Harris. And quite often you send off the first three chapters. Mm. And so writers put a lot of work into polishing those first three chapters. But then she says she then puts a lot of work into chapter four because otherwise the reader is going to be disappointed. And maybe that's something we're going to talk about the first five pages and what you need to do. But you can't just say, I've done that, now I can write rubbish.
No, but if you think about it, you want to hook the reader and get them to carry on with your book, commit to your book. I always give it a couple of chapters, I think, before I decide not to discard it. But, you know, if you are... in the process of submitting to agents, I've heard agents talk at workshops, and what they say is, number one, you need to say why you're sending it to me. So your covering letter has to introduce the book, say why you've chosen me. So sending a covering letter saying, dear agent, ain't going to cut it. Mm-hmm. And you then give them the, maybe the first three chapters, you give them what they ask for.
Yeah.
If they like your covering letter, they will then start reading the manuscript. And some of them will get to the first typo, first thing they don't like, and not read any more. So, if you can't make those first five pages really sing, and you are serious about finding an agent or publishing...
It's very much like job applications. When I was still working, we could get hundreds of people applying for a post. You literally go through, and if you told somebody that you should write it in capital letters and black pen, whatever you've asked for, anybody who hasn't done that doesn't even get looked at.
So it could be the best book in the world, but if you haven't... assuming they do then start reading your manuscript, those first five pages have to really engage them in exactly the same way as it should engage the reader.
We've talked about, if it doesn't hook you, there are different types of hook, aren't there? Mm-hmm. So
absolutely.
What actually hooks you?
Well, I'm struggling with our book club read at the moment, which is called
Half of a Yellow Sun.
Yeah, because the first few pages were very good, and they were from the point of view. And you said something interesting earlier, which enabled me to pinpoint why I'm not enjoying it. You said, whose story is this? And I thought at first it was this little boy's story who'd been sent to work as a houseboy.
Yeah.
But we're jumping around into the heads of all different kinds of people, most of whom I don't care about at all. All I want to know is what's happening to the little boy now. Mm-hmm. But I think definitely the issue I'm having is that it's jumping around too much into different people's heads, which is instructional for me writing myself, because you don't, you said, whose story is it? As far as I'm concerned, it's that little boy's story, and I don't really want to know
about the two sisters.
There's the points of view. I want to stay in his point of view.
And is that within the first five pages, or is that?
Yeah, it grabbed me in the first five pages. Mm. As I started to read, it started to jump into other people's heads, and I think too many of them too often.
It's
losing me now.
But how long do you give it?
I used to be religious about never putting a book down because I always wanted to finish it. But you're right, there are too many good books out there, and so it's about, I would say, about 10 or 20 pages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tracy, when I said about different sorts of hooks.
Yeah, I mean, I was just, it doesn't have to be all action, exciting, something like that. And sometimes, you know, it can be a slow burner. But, and you know, this is something when I come to my bedside table, you know, that I'll talk about. But, you know, sometimes it's the writing or something about the situation that intrigues you or interests you. You know, I mean, I think certain writers, you know, like Dan Brown, are very good at grabbing your attention and ending each chapter with a cliffhanger so that you read on. Mm-hmm. But you don't always want to read a breathless kind of read. Mm-hmm. I don't. I like
but
to
I
get
to
into
care.
A book.
I want to care about the protagonist.
Yeah. Know?
I want to care about them. I want to be rooting for them. Or that the, you know, if it's a villain, I want to dislike them. I want something sparked in me. I want to feel some emotion about this person, engaged with them.
Right.
You know, I want to care about them.
Yeah.
And, you know, like The Day of the Jackal, John le Carré, I know it's supposed to be a marvellous book, but I read it, but I never really cared about either the detective or the jackal, really.
Perhaps that's why all the detectives are flawed human beings, because it makes us relate to them and care.
Yeah.
So they're super clever, but they're also super flawed.
Yeah, but they have
flawed.
To have some weakness. Yeah.
What about you, Heather? Do you read
more than that? A few weeks ago, we did something about humour, and I related to a book called Lost for Words by a chap called Derek Longdon. And I read it some years ago, but it made me realise that if something's going to be funny, you want it to be funny straight away.
Mm. Yeah.
And this is the opening to his second book. I would have recognised that backside anywhere. It loomed large above the surprisingly slim ankles, waited impatiently as the arms transferred parcels one to the other, and then it swiveled and slammed into the glass doors before charging triumphantly backwards into Marks and Spencer's, dragging my mother along in its wake.
That's brilliant.
It's the first chapter, first paragraph.
That very first line.
It's going to be funny.
Yeah. It's almost making a contract with the reader, isn't it? The reader, right, this is going to be humorous.
Yeah. Setting the tone.
And about his mum, which is,
It's all about telling him. I mean, one of the greatest openings, I mean, there's several great openings lines, isn't there? But that one about the curious case of the dog in the night, I mean, we all recognised that when we heard it, didn't we?
Just interestingly, I looked at something called The First Page by Maeve Maddox, and one of the things that she said about characters, hook us by the heart with one character first and don't introduce other characters until you're sure that you've set the hook in deep. The problem you're having there. What about settings? I mean, are you grabbed by setting, by place, or is it always about character for you?
No, I think you like to know where they are in the world.
Otherwise it distracts you. If you don't know where they are, you're wondering about it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking of, are there any, you know, novels that you can recall where it has been that sort of sense of place that has been the sort of key to
keeping. I don't know about the key, but I think, you know, you want to know where somebody is. And
I do like a sense of place, and I talked about this when I talked about The Black House for my bedside table in the Isle of Lewis, you know, and I think that kind of sets it apart as a little bit above the average detective thriller, because it's in an unusual and interesting location with its own culture and history. So,
and certainly a village called Far Away.
Most important.
Fenion and those kind of specific details that tell us that it's in Greece, or the journey on the bus from Athens bus station. I mean, I love those kind of senses of place. When she came over the hill on the bus and looked down and saw the turquoise water and that sort of thing. I mean, that to me is a very important part of it. And in some books, the setting can become a character in their own right. You know, Paris can become a character, or London. Or
certainly
Chicago,
in Dickens, London is very much a character.
Yeah. I quite like the Peter May books when he's talking about Shetland, and I think the same thing, you get a picture of where they are and the weather and all sorts of things about it. That's really good.
Well, the V.I. Wachowski books I really enjoy, because it's set in Chicago. Now, you'd expect it to be New York or L.A., and the fact that it's in Chicago is quite different for me, because I'm not familiar with the landmarks or the buildings, so it doesn't intrude, but it does add a different difference to it.
Yeah, and it adds in as much as it, like, really grounds.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And the weather's always terrible.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, and the other one that springs to mind was the one that was, you know, it was a Scandi noir thing. It was a bit like The Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was set in Seattle, The Killing. And it just constantly rained in that, and it was really atmospheric. It was really atmospheric.
Yeah. I can be caught up with setting in the opening if it's something that it has to be, you know, it has to be promising that there's an interesting person around.
Mm.
And the way that, like, for example, if you see an old shack in a barren place and hot and whatever, and the green door is swinging and flopping, that, but there's a pot with a flower in it that's growing, mm-hmm. you know, that somebody has to be around there somewhere. And I can be made to continue reading until I see the person. Mm-hmm. Then you have to interest me in the person.
Though. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But mostly I like characters to drive me in.
Yeah.
You know, pull me in there.
Well, mm-hmm. I've got an example of an opening which doesn't introduce the main character. Uh-huh. If I can share it with you.
Yeah.
And this is the prologue to a book called Mistress of the Art of Death by Arianna Franklin. And it's set in the 12th century, and it's against a detective, but she's a female doctor, which would be very rare. But at the beginning, it starts, "Here they come. From down the road we can hear harness jingling and see dust rising into the warm spring sky. Pilgrims returning after Easter in Canterbury. Tokens of the mitred, martyred St. Thomas are pinned to cloaks and hats. Canterbury monks must be raking it in. The pilgrims offer a pleasant interruption in the traffic of carts whose drivers and oxen are surly with fatigue from ploughing and sowing. These people are well-fed, noisy, exultant, with the grace their journey has gained them. But one of them, as exuberant as the rest, is a murderer of children. God's grace will not extend to a child killer." So that's quite a strong And then she goes on to introduce, very much in the style of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, the different characters. So there's a prioress and a nun and a knight and a squire and so on. And that's what she does. But as she introduces these characters, you know one of them is a murderer.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a very strong opening, not introducing the main character, not introducing any of those characters in detail except as types and figures in the landscape.
So using as the hook, one of these first people,
I looked at the first few pages of Mary Ann by Daphne du Maurier. The very first sentence says that Mary Ann is dead. Yeah. So we're going to tell you a story about somebody that's already died. And then over the next couple of pages, we get the impression that although Mary Ann could be unkind and untruthful and manipulative and so on, she's very much remembered for the good things about her, for her warmth, her generosity, and just her sheer exuberance and love of life. And then, in the next few pages, we get four deathbed accounts. So four men remember her on their deathbeds, which I thought was really quite powerful because, you know, for a man to think of you on his deathbed,
you were important
to him.
Yeah.
And so that sort of told me that she was quite charismatic. I haven't met Mary Ann yet, but, you know.
And in a way, you know, you could have lost us there because she's dead. The four blokes are dead.
Yeah.
Who are you?
Exactly.
Right.
Whose story is it?
Yeah, exactly.
We then learn that she came from humble beginnings and became the mistress of a duke. Mm. So this is, you know, the important things. And that led to a national scandal and she ended her days in France alone and unloved. So we already know the ending of the story
at this point.
Another no-no, you'd think.
Yeah,
you?
Absolutely. The way that Daphne du Maurier showed the setting in this book is she talks about taverns, the royal family being the House of Brunswick, which immediately puts it at time. The Dome of St. Paul's is clear against the sky, so it's London where there's no buildings around it. There are slops being thrown in the street, so it's pre-sanitation.
Yeah.
Black-edged obituary notices on, you know, the walls.
Yeah.
Horse-drawn carriages, that kind of thing. So without actually going, the year is,
you're
getting a very good sense of where the year is. And I think as readers, the reason I was... So all of that you might think is a no-no. So here's somebody that's dead, the four people that loved her are dead, she died unwanted and alone in France because she was such a scandalous woman, and she, you know, she lived a long time ago. But I think I wanted to know, how did she reach such dizzying heights to be the mistress of a duke? Yeah. And then what did she do that was so awful that her grandchildren are now ashamed of her? And what drove her to behave as she did? And was she unpleasant or just misunderstood? Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's to me, it was a brilliant
setup.
But it did it in a very... classic way,
And whose point of view does it turn out to be told from?
Well, that's
it's an omniscient. The story is an omniscient narrator, but,
so it is basically the flashback. Or it starts at the end.
Daphne du Maurier's. This was actually the reason I read it was because Mary Ann was Daphne du Maurier's great grandmother in real life,
right?
And she was the mistress of the Duke of York, I think.
Right.
And it did cause a national scandal. Mm-hmm. So it's very well documented. It was the 17th century. Very well documented in the time, because of all the court cases, and the Prince of Wales had to appear in court. So there's a lot of good supportive historical reference material. But I just thought that, you know...
Yeah,
and maybe that's one reason she chose to start by saying, this woman's dead.
Yeah.
She was an old baggage in her time. Bit of a strumpet, has an affair with Duke, you know.
Well, I read a book many years ago called The Bird Artist, and I'm so sorry, I can't remember the author. It was, in the very first paragraph, it told you who committed the murder. There's a murder. And then you'd think, you know, that's supposed to be reserved for much later if it's a detective novel, but the whole book then was about unfolding the process that you know had happened. And it was fascinating to read from that, like turning it all around backwards. It was just wonderful too. It was so suspenseful.
But it is about us getting us to ask questions about the character, isn't it?
So even though in some ways questions have been answered, you were still left wondering what the hell happened.
And I think that's probably what you have to do in the first 5 minutes. Get the reader asking questions, perhaps.
Right.
I don't know.
Just one thing that I was thinking before, I think we were talking about the writing. Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, the Hillary Mantel. I can't remember the opening few pages of either of them, but I can remember, I think I actually read them in reverse order. I read Bring Up the Bodies first. And what hooked me was the quality of the writing.
Yes. Yeah.
And I was just...
In terms of what the descriptive passage is, or where the commas were placed?
It was
placed,
just so
or...
beautifully written.
The words were just... The vocabulary.
The phrasing. Everything. And I just enjoyed that so much.
Yeah.
I mean, the story was great. The characterization, everything. But in the first instance, it was that
elegant. It's a huge disappointment, isn't it? Some of us like certain books and some of us don't. But
A lot of people would have said,
there probably is no magic formula, but I do think if you're going to engage people and you make people want to read on, they have to care about the character.
I think so.
Right.
Definitely. Well, thank you for that, ladies. Now, we just have time to hear from Teresa. She's going to tell us what's on her bedside table. And following that, Liz Stoker will talk about her choice.
Yeah, on my bedside table at the moment is The Narrow Road to the Deep North by Richard Flanagan. And this was the winner of the Man Booker Prize in 2014, described by the Sunday Times as devastatingly beautiful. On the back cover, it tells us, in the despair of a Japanese POW camp on the Burma Death Railway, surgeon Dorrigo Evans is haunted by his love affair with his uncle's young wife 2 years earlier. Struggling to save the men under his command from starvation, from cholera, from beatings, he receives a letter that will change his life forever. This is a story about the many forms of love and death, of war and truth, as one man comes of age, prospers, only to discover all that he has lost. So the novel starts much earlier with Dorrigo's childhood in a very remote part of Tasmania during the years of the First World War. And again, it's a great opening, great first 5 pages. And he's a very small child and he's shocked to see an adult man crying at the kitchen table. And of course, in that era, in that culture, this was never seen. the writing is so beautiful and restrained. So I totally agree with what Pat was saying a moment ago, that that in itself draws you in. And it flashes effortlessly back and forward in time as Dorrigo, an old man, reflects on his childhood and the changes he's witnessed in his long life. I'm drawn in. There's an atmosphere of something epic to be revealed to the reader. It's poetic, it's compelling, it's a very beautiful book.
What was the name of it again?
The Narrow Road to the Deep North.
It's a
quotation from a Japanese poet.
Okay.
And so part of it, you know, during the war, it's his relation, the relationship that they have with the Japanese when they're prisoners as well. But a very good book. Highly recommended.
Mm. Sounds very interesting. Okay, and now we're going to hear from Liz Stoker.
Hi, my name's Liz Stoker, and on my bedside table is The Yard by Alex Grecian. The Yard is set in Victorian London and is a crime story set the year after Jack the Ripper, and it's about the new murder squad that's been created and some crimes that they're investigating. What I really like about it is that there are lots of threads that are weaving together, so there are different plot lines that I'm not sure yet, because I haven't finished, exactly how they're going to join up. And yes, it's unpredictable, unexpected, and very dark.
Okay, well, thank you, Liz. That does sound good. Well, that's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us again next time. Meanwhile, why not invite a friend to join us as well? And so that's it from all of us. Bye.
Bye. Bye.